Seems to me that we're here to try to understand what Shankaracharya is trying to do, right? Or say. Okay. So there's really, at least for the point of view of this class, the thing that's stressed on by Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is simply the question of whether the Absolute Truth has energies or not. And that he has energies is called Parinamavada, or Shakti Parinamavada, that the world arises out of the transformation of the energies of Krishna. But the Mayavad position ultimately denies energies of the Absolute Truth. He has no energies. He is the Lord of nothing. That's right.
Is it called Parinamavada when the Lord has energies?
Yeah, that's called Parinamavada. Vada again means doctrine or teaching. And Shankara's doctrine is this Vivarta Vada. That because the trick is now to account for the existence of the world.
But Shankara says that the Saguna Brahman
has existence. Yeah, he says the Saguna Brahman. Whenever you talk about God in relationship to the world, then we're talking Saguna Brahman. Because he can't just out and out say that those texts which say the Lord has energies do not exist. That you have to go to Vedic Village Review to find that kind of a technique. He has to admit the existence of these texts. So he assigns them to a lesser reality. His term is, he says there's two ways of talking. One is the, you know, high knowledge, and one is conventional way of speaking. The Sanskrit terms for those, the high one is paramartha. I forgot the conventional, the Sanskrit term for conventional. If you want, I can look it up for you. It's conventional mode of speech. So there's two ways of speaking. One was the way we speak just for convenience. Granted the fact that we're all in Maya, then this is what we do. Here's the world, here's the Vedas, here are their injunctions, here's students, here's teachers, here's the gods, here's the Lord from whom everything emanates. That's conventional. And until we reach the stage of knowledge, we accept this lower truth, which is really falsehood. Remember the word? Mithya? Jagan Mithya. So when they say the world is false, what they mean by the world, this is what's hard for us to understand, is the God-world complex. You understand? It's Saguna Brahman emanating and reabsorbing the world, and that's what's all false. And that exists as an illusory superimposition upon Brahman, Nirguna Brahman. That's like this flawless mirror upon which this image is somehow cast. That's my example, not his. You know. His word is... some paramartha. Paramartha, paramartha. I think it's paramartha. I'll look it up for you. Don't, you know, put a question mark by it if you write it down, because I'm not so sure.
Is it speaking in the higher?
Yeah, the higher thing. And the other one is begins with a V, Y, you know, I can't remember the rest of it. Oh, darn. Would it be in here? No, I don't think so. No, it's not mentioned in the CC. Yeah, this supreme. See, because that's a similarity with Buddhists. Buddhists also have this same kind of. They have two. I'll give you the terms tomorrow, because the Buddhists also have their terms for the higher reality and the lower conventional reality. So what you get are these two truths. Almost any absolutistic philosopher, who has a monistic system, ends up with a kind of two truths sort of a thing. In the West too, they do the same thing.
Socrates and
Skeens. No, not exactly Socrates. Socrates doesn't deny that the world exists, but there are the so-called absolute idealists who do deny the existence of the external world. It's either projection of our consciousness. That starts out with Parmenides and the Greeks. There was a guy named Parmenides, and he said, the one alone exists and no other things. And his pupil was a fellow by the name of Zeno, who's famous for his paradoxes. You must have heard Zeno's paradoxes. You know the one that motion doesn't exist? He says that, say you're going to go from here to here, right? Now, motion consists of, as you go from here to here, first you're going to go halfway, and then the process, you're going to go half of that, and then you're going to go half of that, and then you're going to go half of that, and then you're going to go half of that, and you keep halving, and you never get there, because it's infinitely divisible. So therefore, motion is impossible. So he has a number of things that are called Zeno's paradoxes. But Zeno's point was to prove that the material world, if you looked at it, is full of self-contradictions. And therefore, it couldn't possibly exist. You see, in philosophy, this idea of something is self-contradictory, it doesn't exist. Like, for example, and I can know that without having to go and look. For example, there's non-existent things in India they talk about, eggs of a horse. Now, if I want to know there are no horses' eggs, I have to go and look at all the horses and find out that they don't lay eggs, right? But another example of something that doesn't exist is the son of a barren woman. That is the son of a woman who has no sons. Now, I can tell you there's no such thing without going anywhere, because just by the meanings of the terms, it's self-contradictory, you know?
Proved what?
That you could be the son of a barren woman. That's a little tricky. Just like, you know, Macbeth was killed of a man not born of a woman too, you know. He was from his mother's womb untimely ripped, you know, that was anyway, Shakespeare. Anyway, so the point is that's what Zeno was trying to do. And this is what we'll see with the Buddhist Nagarjuna, same thing. He wants to show that all views, all positions you can take about reality are all self-contradictory. Yeah. Anyway, let's get back to Shankaracharya.
Can we go back to the handout from Tulip Kuhn on the first page? Beginning, it stated, the refutation contained in the preceding sutra was set forth on the condition of the practical distinction of enjoyable objects of enjoyment being acknowledged. Mm-hmm. In reality, however, that distinction does not exist, because it is understood to be a non-difference of cause and effect.
Mm-hmm.
Well, could you just go over what I mean by non-difference of cause and effect?
Well, for Shankara, it means identity. That's what he goes on to show. Which means he takes it to be non-difference. What the example of the clay shows is that the cause and the effect are of the same substance. What he takes it to mean is that the cause and effect are wholly identical in every way whatsoever, which means there really is no effect. I mean, he starts off by talking about the identity of cause and effect. The notion is that if there's something is in the effect, it must be in the cause. There's nothing in the effect that is not first in the cause. This is called Satkaryavada. There's other people who say Asatkaryavada, you know, that effects have things that aren't in the causes. That's a whole nother monumental discussion. But Satkaryavada. Satkaryavada, that the effects pre-exist in the cause. That's off. We agree with that too. You cannot give what you have not got. But there's a lot of people who, you know, want to say that effects are greater than the causes. Like modern science. And when there's more in the effect than in the cause, that's due to chance. Chance means it happened without a cause. But anyway, so he says, but then he wants to understand there's absolutely none difference of cause and effect. See what Shankara, that's what he's trying to say. Yeah, what it comes down to, and therefore there are no effects. His real doctrine is, right, by the time you get to the end of this passage, is that there the unreality of all effects. Right, isn't that what he says? In reality, there exists no such thing as a modification. You see, like the idea of modification. For Shankaracharya, he uses this word, upadi. Let me make sure I spelled that right. Upadi means limiting adjunct. So the doctrine is that Brahman has no upadis. That any time we think of Brahman as having name is an upadi, form is an upadi. You see, Brahman having a world is an upadi. You see, here's Brahman, right? And it's limitless. So I've drawn a circle, but imagine this circle is infinite circle, right? As soon as there's a world or jivas, then there's a limitation on Brahman. Because here's Brahman, and here's the thing that says, creates a limitation. Because here this Brahman then becomes a this and a not that. And therefore there's a limit. Well, that's another thing. But we're just talking about what he says. You know, that's our philosophy, of course. This is Achincha Beda Beda Tattva. We say nothing is different from Krishna, which is Shankara's position too, that all these things are illusions in a way. But Krishna is different from everything. This is the inconceivable oneness and difference between Krishna and his energies. But anyway, that's the argument, that all these things are upadis. There would be limiting adjuncts, and therefore he has to be free from all upadis. But, say, I keep introducing more words and not fewer. The same thing, instead of upadi, in Ramanuja is called a vishesha. Yeah, they say nirvishesha. We say vishesha, but we say, yeah, there are visheshas. But they're not limitations. After all, because the argument can be made, if Brahman doesn't have energies, if he doesn't have a world, that's also a limitation. If he has nothing to lord it over, that's also a limitation. Huh? Yeah, we use that term, vishesha. Varieties. Or particularities. Yeah, but Mayavadis too. No visheshas, nirvishesha. Nirvishesha, or no upadis, these limiting conditions. You see? So as soon as you have this idea of God and there's energies and there's a world and there's creatures and there's relationships, then immediately, see, God is compromised. Now the same argument is there in the theologian Paul Tillich. He says, this is his argument, that God is not the highest being among all beings, because that would limit him. Therefore, God is being itself. Paul Tillich, T-I-L-L-I-C-H. We got a reading from him. Beyond theism, he says. He's a Lutheran theologian. But he says this, just like that. If God were the highest being among all beings, that would limit him. Because he would be one being among many. So therefore, he's being itself. And of course, our philosophy is, well, he's both. If he's just being itself, that limits him too. So why not say he's both? Nothing is different from Krishna. Krishna is different from everything. In one sense, the absolute truth means Krishna and Krishna's energies. It's right there. Hare Krishna. Hare is the energies and Krishna is there. So when we say Hare Krishna, we then exhaust the whole contents of reality. Krishna and Krishna's energies. Because you can't conceive Krishna without his energies any more than you can conceive of the sun without the sunshine. And yet at the same time, when we say the sun is in the room, we don't mean the sun globe is in the room. The energies are at the same time one and different. Yeah. So what is meant by his two-tiered system is this idea that there's two Brahmans, either as higher or lower. There's this higher Brahman, when Brahman is the object of knowledge, then this higher Brahman is this nirvishesha, nirguna, impersonal Brahman. In that Brahman, there is no energies, there's no differences, everything's just one undifferentiated identity, right? However, when Brahman is looked at from the point of view of ignorance, then it appears as the Lord, and categories such as devotee, act of devotion, object of devotion, apply. That's exactly what he says. I think I gave you a handout. 114, I think it is. Where he precisely says like that. I don't seem to have it with me. 1-4? Yeah, here it is. No, excuse me. 1-1-11. Brahman is apprehended under two forms. Right? See if you follow this. Brahman is apprehended under two forms. In the first place is qualified by limiting conditions, upadis, owing to the multiformity of the evolution of name and form. That is, the multiformity of the created world. Limiting conditions, modified, qualified by these things. In the second place, that is to say, the second form, the higher form, as being the opposite of this, free from all limiting conditions whatsoever. Right? Free from all upadis. We also use that term by sarva upadi vinirmuktam, tat paratvena nirmalam, sarva upadi vinirmuktam. Devotional service is free from all material conditions, sarva upadis, you know. That's where that word shows up in our vocabulary. Then he gives a lot of passages. And then he says, we don't have to believe him, but he says, all these passages, with many others, declare Brahman to possess a double nature, according as it is the object either of knowledge or of nescience, ignorance. As long as it is the object of nescience, there are applied to it the categories of devotee, object of devotion, and the like. And then he says devotion leads to different results. And he ends up by saying, Brahman, he says, the Shastras teach two Brahmans, on the one hand, or Brahman in two ways, as connected with limiting conditions, that's those upadis, and forming, page 64. From all this it appears that the following part of the Shastra has a special object of its own to show the Vedanta teach, texts teach, on the one hand, Brahman is connected with limiting conditions and forming an object of devotion, and on the other hand, as being free from the connection with such conditions and constituting an object of knowledge. So devotion is linked to ignorance. That's right, it's right here. And one reason I just wanted to see that you could see for yourself what he actually says. That's what he says. This is Mayavad philosophy. So generally people think as long as we imagine God to be a person, then we worship him, but then we have knowledge he realizes not a person, that we're all identical and we become one. And I become God. This is the standard. This is where it all comes from. This stuff right here. Yeah?
What is the theory of superimposition?
So the theory of superimposition is we look around and we live in the world, and this world is characterized by name and form, right? And think of Shankaracharya's world. There are brahmacharis, grihasthas, vanaprasthas, sannyasis, there's the brahmanas doing the Vedas, there's the sacrifice, they're the Vedas. They're part of the established word, you know? It's like the world, I mean, they're there. There's the Vedas, they're the demigods, they're there. There's the highest god, all of that's there. It's there. But we understand that actually the highest truth is Brahman. None of these things are there. So how did this come about? Vivarta. It's an illusion. It's the illusory superimposition upon Brahman of the varieties of this world in the same way that you at night you see a rope and you think it's a snake. The idea of the snake is superimposed upon the rope. So in the same way, this dream of a world, this non-existent world, the idea of it is superimposed upon Brahman. Because Brahman is the background, it appears real. Because the reality is there in the Brahman. So there's actually consciousness there, but it's false consciousness.
How can that be?
You can it? That's our philosophy.
In what way you can say that the whole philosophy of Samacharya is actually superimposition on the true Vedas?
That's right. That's exactly right. That's what I say.
But the thing is that, if he says that the real reality, Nirguna Brahman, is nothing, absolutely nothing, then how can you have a superimposition that has more qualities than the thing that it's meant to be based on?
Mm-hmm. Good point. Good point. Where does it come from? Because Jiva Goswami says, if you take the ordinary cases of illusory superimposition, say if I see a snake imposed upon this rope, it means that I had previous experience of an actual snake, which is then recalled to mind and confused with the rope. So what, in order to be illusory superimposition on Brahman, there must have been some previous experience. Otherwise, how can you call it illusory superimposition? Now, they may have an answer to that. If you want to really get even further into it, the guy to see is Satyanarayana Prabhu, who studied all this stuff, and in Sanskrit. And you can really get into the ins and outs. You know, in India, for hundreds of years, the followers of Madhva and the followers of Shankaracharya have been debating each other on these kinds of points. For centuries, they meet and they have formal debates. No one has changed their mind. No one has become a devotee. But they debate. We should know what these positions actually are. But you can understand our business is to preach Krishna consciousness. and to find those people who actually want to become devotees, but they have some idea like this in their head, you know. But the way most people will express it will be very simple. Well, we're projecting our idea of on God. When we think that God has form, we're projecting our idea on God. You know, Sankaracharya is just a very sophisticated presentation of that kind of simple, unsophisticated notion. That most people, you know, many people have. When they see Krishna, they'll first, oh, well, you're just imagining him to be a human being, aren't you? You know, that's just your, actually, God is indescribable. And that's the way you'll hear it. Once in a while, you'll run into somebody who's had a course in Hinduism and had a fairly good teacher and didn't fall asleep and got a good grade, and he might be able to tell, you know, get a little bit more into it. If you're in India, you really may meet some real Mayavadis. Or somebody who's actually studied Vedanta Sutra. It depends on, you know, your circumstances, who you meet. So do we understand illusory superimposition, what the idea is? So you have to ask, you know, who is illusioned? And it has to be Brahman. But you see, as I said in class yesterday, that as a piece of constructive metaphysics, it's a really bad job. And the answer, I guess, would be that it's not meant to be a piece of constructive metaphysics. It's really not meant to give a picture of the world and how it is coherent, because it's definitely incoherent. What it is it's therapeutic. It's designed that you study this philosophy in connection with rigid austerities, you know, you'll experience nirguna Brahman. That's what it's designed for. It's not designed to give an account of the world. So that the faults we find with it, that it can't account for the world, does not weigh so heavily with them. That's what they'll say, something like that. The fault we find for it, that the existence of the world is totally inexplicable. They'll say, yeah, it is inexplicable. And, you know, reality is not coherent. As long as there's illusion, reality is not coherent, because of these two things, illusion and knowledge. And when it becomes a coherent, illusion disappears. That's what knowledge means, right? There's no more illusion. Then the world doesn't exist, and you don't have a problem to solve.
You were explaining before that there's no way to go from one to the other.
Yeah, you can't.
Could you explain that a little further?
Well, if you ask yourselves, like if a constructive metaphysical system, what is the relationship between nirguna and saguna Brahman, or between God and the world, you find there isn't any relationship. I guess the relationship would be illusory superimposition, which is no relationship at all. What relationship does the snake that I imagine have with the rope that's on the ground? Well, it has no relationship. There's some similarity in form, which is a feature of the example, which doesn't carry over to the thing that's being explained. There's no relationship. You know, it's like, say I'm in a room at night and I'm dreaming. And so in my dream, there's a tree. Well, let's say it's a desk. In my dream, there's a desk. Now, can I ask this question? How far is it from the desk in the dream to the floor of my room? You can't ask that question, right? Because there's no spatial relationship. So in Shankara's system, there is no relationship between, you know, the higher and the lower Brahman. One is ignorance and the other is knowledge. But that's so far as you go, so long as you're, that's okay, so long as you're just dealing with psychology. But it also is supposed to give us an account of how the existence of the world. And it can't. You see, as soon as you say there's a real relationship, then you have to say that ignorant exists. As soon as you say it exists, then you've qualified nirguna Brahman. You've got something else existing beside it. So then it doesn't exist. Well, if it doesn't exist, what's all the fuss about? You know, why are we trying to get enlightened? If there is no ignorance, then, you know, there's no illusion and the world is real. So they have to say it cannot be described either as existing or not existing. That's their anirvachaniya. So the whole pivot of the system, you know, this is like the crack that runs down the middle of it. And if you just rap it hard, you know, on that crack, the whole thing falls apart.
So you're saying that when we're discussing with them, we shouldn't allow them. Because they say, well, it doesn't exist and it doesn't not exist. That we should say, well, that's not allowed. You have to clarify yourself.
Yeah, which is it?
So some might say, well, in the Upanishad, it describes the Supreme Lord walks and he does not walk. And so we're also doing things like this. So how can we...
That's God. God is always said to be the repository of inconceivable characteristics. But this isn't God we're describing. This is the existence of Maya. So the question is, you're asking is, well, how does this anirvachaniya differ from achincha? You know, because Krishna has achincha shakti. You know, you could say, well, that's a self-contradiction too. But that's said to reside in the Lord because that's the nature of the Supreme, that he has many inconceivable things. But they're not saying that something has inconceivable potencies. They're saying that something cannot be described either as existing or non-existing. See, that's not a statement about Maya, or the qualities of Maya. That's a statement about their philosophical system. That they can't have it either way. You know, so it's a whole different order of being.
So if we tell them, you're not allowed, you know, look, clarify your position. You can't say,
well, then if they say, well, what about God? You say, we'll talk about God later. Let's just stick to the point. You know, you got to keep people on the point a lot of times, you know.
So how will they try to square up with them?
Well, what I've heard is usually, you know, something like a very kind of patient, you know, you're asking very simple questions. And the fact is the material world is indescribable. And that, you know, when you come to knowledge, when you come enlightened, the problem will be solved because it will not exist. The ignorance will vanish. So it's only a problem from the point of view of ignorance. From the point of view of knowledge, the problem doesn't exist. And then you say, well, tell me something. The doctrine that there are these two point of views, is that knowledge or is that ignorance? And if they say it's knowledge, then they've admitted the existence of ignorance. And if they say they're ignorant, it's ignorance, then the whole thing, their whole philosophy is admittedly not ignorance. Nonsense. How can it tell us about the truth?
They say it's knowledge, and you say, but it includes all these varieties and forms.
Yeah, it's knowledge, but I thought knowledge was non-dual. You got a duality, knowledge and ignorance.
So they can't really understand
it. Yeah, we'd have to get a real Mayavadi here to really represent this. You know, it's a fact that I haven't really run into anybody like this in a long time. You know.
Such an Orion Prabhu pretend to be a Mayavadi.
Oh, he'd probably defeat us all. Yeah.
Oh, but
I have to go talk to him about that.
That would be really interesting to have a debate as one of the classes.
Yeah, we'll see. He's a little difficult to follow. I don't know if he may just come in and tell you that everything I've taught you is wrong anyway about all the money. Yeah.
The Nirvana
So nirguna, guna means three modes of material nature, really qualities in general, but usually three modes of material nature. So nirguna means Brahman, that's impersonal, that therefore has no qualities beyond the modes of material nature. Actually, we say Krishna is also nirguna. We don't disagree with that, but by guna, he has beyond the three modes of material nature, right? But they are already assuming that all qualities are material qualities. So if he is nirguna, he doesn't have transcendental qualities. And saguna means Brahman with material qualities, which is to say, personal God, in their terms. Anybody know how Prabhupada uses saguna Brahman to refer to? Brahman with qualities? He uses it to refer to the deity. The deity is saguna Brahman. Apparently material qualities. But for them, the saguna Brahman is personal God, which, according to whether it's viewed through the mode of goodness, is Vishnu, viewed through the mode of passion, is Brahma, viewed in connection with the mode of ignorance, is Shiva, you know, the universal form of Vishnu is saguna Brahman from their point of view. And what does Prabhupada say about the universal form? He says it's something like imagination. So this is what they mean by saguna, or Brahman, the lower Brahman. Now what I was trying to do the other day is appreciate one way that you can see that even though Shankaracharya sets up this whole system, is he's actually a devotee. Because this saguna Brahman is not the Lord. This is God viewed through ignorance. So if you think, you see, that God has material qualities. If you think that as the world comes out through parinama from him, he becomes reduced, all this is an ignorant idea of God. So in denying that, Shankaracharya has just denied something that we also deny. These are all wrong ideas about God. It's a materialistic idea of God. And then he substitutes for that this nirguna Brahman, as having no name, form, qualities, pastimes, as being the reality. But then you see he does that in such a way that in his system you have to call this contrast between these two Brahmans into question if you start to get into it. And you say, wait a minute, this is supposed to be a non-dual system. There's supposed to be non-duality. But this conception of nirguna Brahman is itself part of a duality. The only way you can understand what he means by nirguna Brahman is if you understand what he means by saguna Brahman. So this idea of nirguna Brahman is also a materially conditioned idea. Relative, right. So what's the real truth? That's not the truth either. So then, if you're pushing really hard to try to understand what the truth is and say it's something that has both of these features and is higher than both, then the idea is there of transcendental name, transcendental form, transcendental qualities, which is not Shankaracharya's saguna Brahman, not exactly his nirguna Brahman, but which has the features of both. Sounds contradictory. He simultaneously has form and no form. He walks and he does not walk. Krishna simultaneously has form and no form. Does that mean he's impossible? No, we know exactly what it means. He has no material form, but he has spiritual form. And there's the solution. And that's what Shankaracharya is actually, in a tricky way, indicating. But it's not on the surface. It's that when you get into this philosophy, at a certain point it self-destructs and indicates Krishna consciousness. So in this way, he remains a devotee, even while appearing to teach this philosophy. It's very, very tricky. Anyway, as I said personally, that was my own experience with this Shankaracharya, you know, when I met devotees. I suddenly could understand what Shankaracharya was trying to say. And I could understand that this duality between Saguna and Nirguna Brahman had to be overcome, and that it was indicating Krishna. So it was because of Shankaracharya I became a devotee.
So
we'll go over this again, because this is part of this whole, you know, dialectical argument that the last part of the class is going to be dealt with. So here you have the notion of form, right? So you're trying to get your way to... Let's say we're going to try to speculate our way to God, right? So here's our notion of form, as we have. You know, your form, my form, this form, that form. We could take form, quality, activity, any of these terms, you know? So I want to understand spirit. Well, it's the negation of all these things, right? So I say, no form, right? And this is the Mayavad position, no form. But I'm trying to understand what is absolute. But yet what I've got here is this is a relative material conception. Because look, you can't have no form. The idea of no form can't be there unless the idea of form is there. Right? What does no form mean? Formless. Well, I have to have some idea of form in my mind in order to have the idea of what formless means. These are contraries, and they depend on each other for their meaning.
Is that similar to the Buddhist idea that it must be free from this desire, but that's actually
a desire? Yeah, it can also be another desire. So here I am, I'm still stuck with the duality. So what we'll see in the Mayavadi literature, and especially in Buddhist literature, is the idea to somehow like go beyond these two to something higher. This is where you meditate on koans. What is the union of form and formless? You know? That kind of notion. And they meditate on like that, the union of form and formless. And it, you know, it's always end up in some kind of mystification. So we see, you know, with Nagarjuna, samsara is nirvana and nirvana is samsara. You know? Just to get your mind rid of all ideas. You know? So here's like a spirit, here you go. Now how do we get beyond this? So let's redefine our terms. Form means material form. Okay, so the negation means no material form. So if we have this last idea, spiritual form, what is that? That solves it, because here, spiritual form, it's a form, right? And no form, no material form. So that's how you end up with a synthesis. So this, as I said, this is sort of progression in the dialectic called thesis, antithesis, synthesis.
But that's just the definition.
What's the definition? It's form in the sense that it's a form, it's a spiritual form. It's form, but it's not material. Now you can go on and say, well, what is that? We have no idea of such a thing. You know, how do I know it exists? You know, and so on. We'll discuss that later. But you know, because from the Mayavadi will say this is a contradictory account. There can be no such thing as spiritual form, because by definition, form means material form. We have not seen spiritual form. Well, you haven't seen. That doesn't mean I haven't seen. I'm not a rascal like you. You can't see spiritual form until you have spiritual senses. Your senses are material. Why are your senses material? Because you do not engage them in the service of Krishna. You just try to negate them. Same thing. This is with the objects. You know, we're dealing with form here. Let's take something else. Let's take karma. Activity. Right? So you start off with the idea of material activity. And the Mayavad position is no karma. No activity. That's the negation. And that's exactly what Shankaracharya teaches. He says that the seeds, the roots, of the causes of all activity are avidya and kama, desire and ignorance. And when these two things stop, activity ceases. That's exactly what he says. In this paper on deity worship, I had to quote him because nobody would believe it when I just said he said it. So I had to dig it out of one of his commentaries in the Gita just to prove to people that's what he said. No karma. What's the devotional position? It's the synthesis. It's devotional activity. It's activity, right? But it's not material. It produces no reaction. It's as action and inaction, huh? As Krishna says. So many things are there. Prabhupada says something that sounds really Buddhistic, you know. He says the chanting of Hare Krishna is silence. You see, there's sound and no sound. There's sound and no... So what I do in these different papers is I suggest the position of Krishna consciousness is the solution to an incomplete attempt at arriving at the Supreme. That this Mayavad philosophy is a kind of a halfway stage and you have to go further. And the further step is Krishna consciousness. So that you do the same thing with the system. Here's, you know, saguna, nirguna, with material qualities, no material qualities, transcendental qualities. He refers to them in Bhagavad Gita as Saguna Brahman.
What is Nirguna Brahman?
Krishna. Yeah, Krishna has no material qualities. He's Nirguna Brahman.
So the whole spiritual world
is Nirguna. Right. There are no gunas there. There's no goodness, passion, and ignorance, right? It's Vishuddha Sattva.
So why are you distinguishing between transcendental guna?
Because by Nirguna, they mean, to them, it means... from their point of view, nirguna means no qualities whatsoever. They don't recognize the existence of transcendental qualities.
But for us,
saguna, with material qualities, without material qualities. We say, yeah, we say also without material qualities. But that does not mean no transcendental qualities. If Krishna doesn't have a material body, it doesn't mean that he is just disembodied. Yeah. Right. But anyway, this purport in the Bhagavad Gita where he talks about the saguna worship and how it shouldn't be rejected, although it's for the neophyte. Because Krishna does appear as though he's stone or wood, so we can see with our senses. What he does is he turns matter into spirit.
Because actually everything is spiritual anyway.
Yeah, that's right. That's how it can be done. Yeah.
It's just our using it for material purposes. That
yeah, that's right. Anything else? Yeah?
So this idea of this, the proper synthesis is that so good and then transcendental.
Yeah.
Is that the proper synthesis?
Yeah. We'll get into this more at the end. We're way ahead of ourselves, you know. This is by the way, I have to say that, you know, making this argument like this, this is something that I came up with just from Prabhupada's books. This basic argument is there, kind of in a seed form, in the Isha-Upanishad. And I've just developed it more and more, and I've introduced it in various ways in front of scholarly, academic, non-devotee audiences. And so far, nobody's really, had any serious objection to the whole thing. It's a kind of philosophical speculation. Philosophical speculation means that it's speculation, but the result is Krishna. Mental speculation means the result is something else. So this is definitely like speculation, you know. It's a way to convince people of Krishna consciousness. The danger of that is it depends somewhat on your own mental prowess, and you can make a mistake and then somebody can shoot it down. That doesn't necessarily shoot down your conclusion, but it does shoot down your argument. But anyway, it's there, huh?
This word in my notes written down with a question mark beside it, adhikarana?
Yeah, adhikarana, it means a topic heading in the Vedanta Sutra. Subject. Within the sutras, they're grouped together in various subjects, and they're called adhikaranas.
So there would be a few adhikaranas in each pada?
Yeah, the padas, it depends. You know, by some kind of common agreement, like for example, second adhyayana, second pada, sutras, you know, something, something to something, something. The subject is the Buddhists are being refuted. Next subject, the Jains are being refuted. Next, you know, you can't tell from reading the sutras who they're talking about. Yeah.
Mayavadis are, in Prabhupada's books, are always referred to as mental speculators. Do they mental speculate beyond what Shankaracharya already did? Is it an ongoing activity for them?
Well, they always come up in new and different ways, you know. I mean, the school of the Mayavadis, yeah, they do little changes and modifications, and everybody comes up with some original substance. And there are differences between earlier and later Mayavadis. There's a later Mayavadi named Bhaskara who disagrees with Shankara on this and that. And you know what I mean? So they fight among themselves also. So there are different schools like that. And then, you know, it comes up in different ways. You know, like one of the biggest upsurges of Mayavad philosophy that we've got is this business of what I call an unholy alliance between Mayavadi philosophy and modern physics. You know, these books are there, The Tao of Physics, The Dancing Wu Li Masters, that they think they have discovered an amazing coincidence between the, you know, the thought of the ancient seers of India and the conclusions of modern physics. And so a great deal of work is, you know, being done to like unite Mayavad philosophy and modern physics. And that's where you get a lot of it. People have read this stuff, The Dancing Wu Li Masters and all this, things like that. And that's a lot of it right now. I'm not very good at the physics part of it. I've sat down and talked to Sataputta a lot about what they're doing and what they're saying. Another one is this guy Bohm. He wrote a book called Wholeness and the Implicate Order. And it gets pretty technical. These are atomic physicists, you know. Because so far as they think is what's happening, as the more and more they bang particles into each other at higher and higher energy levels, the, you know, substantial world disappears and it just becomes a kind of energy field or a nothingness. And anyway, they encounter so many similarities between their... And they encounter limits, absolute limits on their knowledge. You know, like in the Big Bang Theory, the ultimate thing you get to, what the Big Bang ultimately is starts with a point that's infinitely small, and infinite in mass. And it's not a point in space, it contains all space within it. I mean, when it blows up, that's when space expands, you see? That's what you start with. Now, you know, it's gone off your charts if it's infinitesimally small and infinite, but that, everything comes from that, whatever inconceivable thing it is, you know. And right then, you know, all our formulas stop, all our knowledge ends. Here's the thing that everything, a very mysterious thing. What is it? And there are limits to our knowledge. Because what happens, actually, naturally, is if you start with empiricism, you just start with sense knowledge, and you try to start to understand more and more and push it to the limits, you always encounter the limitations of your own senses. There's a wall you can't see over. There's a veil you can't get behind. There's something beyond. There's something out there about which you can know nothing. And yet it seems to be like an important nothing. There's a modern philosopher, Ludwig Wittgenstein, one of the great philosophers of the 20th century, who was one of the founders of this logical positivistic movement, very, you know, empirical movement, which wanted to establish science as the only valid means of knowledge. And in his book, he wrote his book in a series of seven or eight sentences with subsentences, this Tractatus Logical. The last thing he says is, you know, whereof one cannot speak, thereof one must be silent. You know, it's like he encounters the limits of knowledge, and there, you know, there's this famous for wovon man nicht sprechen kann, darüber muss man schweigen. Whereof one cannot speak, thereof one must be silent, you know. And like nobody can talk, but there's something out there, you know, the mystical something, you know. And then you take the most naturalistic, empirical sort of transcendentalism, which is Buddhist philosophy, you know, and then that kind of hooks in right there. So it's a natural progression. You push empiricism, Buddhism, Shankaracharya. You go from one to the other. So it's very natural that these modern physicists, you know, they're encountering the limits of their own knowledge, and they're now ready to try to go beyond something else too. Also allied with it is the sense that science has really screwed up the world, and that it's lacking in values. It's lacking in direction. So they definitely want to discover something new, some higher truth. So what is it? What do they encounter when they speculate? The same old, you know, the void, the impersonal something, the, you know, opposite of what they know. Not this, not that. But they're just, you know, they're just hitting the edge of the Brahma Jyoti, so to speak, in their speculation. It's very natural that this progression, you know, through Buddhism, Shankaracharya, and they'll become, you know, when they're ready, we'll be ready for them. They just have to develop a little bit, yeah.
You mentioned in the debates between the Madhvacharyas and the Shankaracharyas that no one's ever convinced. Is that just people that are debating, or do the audience?
I just heard this description a long time ago from Prajumna. He just says nobody changes their mind, nobody converts. I imagine the audience is probably all pretty decided one way or another too. Since, you know, since the positions are very well defined and they've been there for a long time. You can see what happens is once you get into this stuff, it becomes enormously technical. And we'll all have our specialists, you know, who do this kind of stuff. Somehow or other you got to do this, you know, when you want to get rigorous, is get all this technical stuff down. But we don't need to know this for preaching our Krishna conscious philosophy. You know? But we should understand basically at least what Shankaracharya says. And a lot of people don't pick it up from reading just, you know, it's Prabhupada tells us, but you know, you don't really pick it up unless you're really alert as to what exactly he's saying.